Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. This is the first function we'd ever have apart from our annual dinner in a big function room like this for over a year, and we haven't had many over 2 years. So we're very grateful to King and Wood Mellison for making this terrific facility available today, where Paul Kelly makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He's well known to all of you here, which is why we've got so many people here and people on Zoom. Editor-at-large for the Australian, his capital Australian government, from Gough Whitlam to Scott Morrison, the author of many, many books, including The End of Certainty on politics and economics of the 1980s, and the Lowy Institute paper, Howard's Decade, among others. But Paul's here tonight on the occasion of the recent publication of Morrison's Mission, How a Beginner Reshaped Australian Foreign Policy, and we've got copies of that book that Paul will sign for after the talk. But as for the talk, welcome to Paul Kelly talking about Prime Minister Scott Morrison's foreign policy mission. Paul, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure for me to be back at the Sydney Institute again. I always enjoy being here, and I want to acknowledge Gerard and Anne Henderson for the sterling job they do at the Sydney Institute and the wide diversity they have in speakers at this institute. So today I'm talking on China, Russia, Ukraine and the United States in the context of Scott Morrison's foreign policy. And this, as Gerard said, follows the recent publication of my book, Morrison's Mission, How a Beginner Reshaped Australian Foreign Policy. I thank the Lowy Institute for inviting me to write this book, and also Penguin as one of the publishers. There are three major themes in this book. First, that Scott Morrison has been Prime Minister at a time of extraordinary global turbulence and disruption, where the strategic order has been fundamentally redefined. So essentially, he in turn has had to make a series of changes and responses in Australian foreign policy. And that while Morrison was a diplomatic novice when he came into the job as Prime Minister, he was seasoned in as much as he'd been a long-serving member of the Cabinet National Security Committee. Neither Tony Abbott nor Malcolm Turnbull had had that advantage when they became Prime Minister. And one of the consequences is that Morrison has taken a series of decisions as Prime Minister which will have long-run consequences for Australian foreign and strategic policy. So what he's done matters. The second point is that Morrison, as far as I can see, has responded as a conviction politician and as a believer, not in foreign policy and security terms, as a marketing man. And I know this will come as a shock to many people, because Morrison has been branded fairly successfully by many of his critics as being a marketing man as a politician. But I argue in the book that the framework for his foreign policy comes very much from a set of beliefs and convictions. They reflect his conservative values. They reflect his security consciousness, his quest for domestic political advantage, and a deep-seated sense of Australia's national interest. Morrison is not a natural diplomat, you may have noticed. And in his approach to foreign policy and the rhetoric of foreign policy, he does often rub people up the wrong way. One of the interesting tangential questions, I think, about Morrison's time as foreign policy prime minister is to ask the question, well, how important is diplomacy anyway? Is it underrated or is it overrated? Certainly, I think assessing Morrison, one's got to look not just at the diplomatic side, but the substantial side, what he's actually done in foreign policy and security policy. He does have a view of the world and a view of global power, and that is that foreign policy is a contest dominated by state power and the quest for national sovereignty. And in this particular approach, Morrison does draw a nexus between national interest and national sovereignty. In particular, he says, well, if we're to be the country we want to be in terms of our values, in terms of being a tolerant, multi-ethnic, a liberal democracy, then we have to ensure that we conduct a foreign policy in the national interest that enables us to realise those objectives. Morrison, in his approach to foreign policy, has relied on traditional norms and faiths. Some of his moves have been bold, but I think to a large extent they've followed an established strategic outlook. His China policy did constitute a sharp departure from that of John Howard, moving the Liberal Party away from Howard's formula of not having to choose between the United States and China. Yet this was widely interpreted within coalition politics and much of the media as being a reaction driven by a different and more dangerous China. Morrison was seen not as staging a revolt against an orthodoxy, but to a certain extent as an exponent of a new orthodoxy given a new and different China. Morrison does bring his own style to the conduct of foreign policy. His instinct is for ambition and activism. He listens to experts, but is not necessarily swayed by them. Like most prime ministers, he backs his own views and judgments. He rarely defers to others, and he puts the stamp of his style, beliefs and judgments all over Australian foreign policy. Anyone who thought that Morrison's initial lack of experience in this area might produce a reticent prime minister in the diplomatic domain was soon disabused. He's an enthusiast. He likes the conduct of foreign policy. He thrives in terms of dialogue with other heads of government. He constantly oversells his own initiatives. He's a quick learner, and as a politician has a good instinct for power. I think that his secret and sustained effort to secure the nuclear-powered submarine decision in conjunction with both the United States and the United Kingdom is a singular example of executive decision-making that only prime ministers can pull off. Now, in these remarks, I'm going to focus in particular on Morrison's dealings with China, his attitude to China, his attitude to the United States, and then I'll talk about his view of the Ukraine. But the point to make about Morrison's attitude towards the Ukraine is that it follows on, to a certain extent, in a seamless way from the foreign policy framework that he'd already put in place. So, in a sense, what he's argued is that he wasn't surprised by what happened with the Ukraine, that he's been warning for the past 3 years that we live in a far more dangerous world where the traditional norms are being broken down and where there's an increasing risk of autocratic states using military power and other means of national assertion to further their interests. In relation to China, Scott Morrison inherited the Malcolm Turnbull framework, and it's certainly true to say that under Malcolm Turnbull as Prime Minister, policy towards China fundamentally changed. We saw the Turnbull government embrace a fundamental change in foreign investment policy, and that, of course, when Morrison was Treasurer. We saw the Turnbull government embrace tough new foreign interference laws based on national security advice, which produced a very sullen and sharp backlash from China. And we saw the Turnbull government right at the very end banning the Huawei technology company from operation in our 5G network. That was clearly the most significant national security decision taken by the Turnbull government, and it's had enormous ramifications. Essentially, what happened there was that in many ways Australia was the first Western country to take that decision, and I think that's had a significant flow-on effect when it comes to other industrialised nations. So China's hostility to Australia in relation to the Huawei decision is not just about what we decided, but it's China's concern about the impact that our decision had on other countries. So what's happened under the Morrison Prime Ministership is that the relationship between Australia and China deteriorated even further. And by the second half of 2020, Morrison saw this deterioration in the bilateral relationship as involving a much bigger question. Would Australia have the resilience to avoid succumbing to the status of becoming a Chinese client state? Now, Morrison never put it quite like that, but that's how he saw it. Now, once Morrison accepted that framing as the challenge, every aspect of China policy assumed a new meaning. For the Prime Minister, this was about foreign policy, but it was also about an existential challenge. The ultimate issue was Australia's autonomy as a liberal democracy. Within the Morrison government, senior advisers saw the issue of having international significance around this test. Was Australia a nation able to confront China's bullying successfully and therefore set an example which could have international significance? Or would Australia become a test case in how not to manage ties with Beijing? So the way we manage the China relationship, I think, clearly was always going to have international significance once China's economic coercion of Australia was joined. A senior official said to me, "Australia is on the leading edge of a global struggle over how the rise of China will play out." It was not so much about China being a direct military threat to Australia, and ministers rarely made any suggestions to that effect. It was rather about China's penchant for using coercive power against Australia to extract changes in our foreign and domestic policy. That is, it was about our sovereignty. It's interesting that after Malcolm Turnbull left office, he spoke more openly about how he saw the challenge that Australia faced from China. In May 2021, drawing upon a famous Cold War analogy, Turnbull said, "We do not want to be to China what Finland was to the Soviet Union. That's the bottom line." The reference to Finlandization, the term used to describe Finland's accommodation of the Soviet Union during the Cold War, did offer an insight, I think, into the private sense of government thinking. The conclusion that Morrison reached, as he conveyed to another senior minister, was that, and I quote, "China will push as far as the rest of the world allows it," unquote. "And if Australia," quote, "does not stand its ground here, we will be forced to stand on more difficult and weaker ground later on," unquote. While some commentators lamented Australia's inept diplomacy with China and its inability to improve relations with Beijing, Morrison's real priority lay elsewhere. It was about building across-the-board resilience against China's intimidation. Andrew Scheer, appointed Director General of the Office of National Intelligence in December 2020, after being Cabinet Secretary, had Morrison's confidence and argued for a dual approach to China based on resilience, protecting domestic institutions and promoting an international alignment to balance Beijing in the region. Although Morrison has never said this, and it would be, I think, unwise for him to say it, I do argue in the book that the ultimate goal of his foreign policy in power terms was to deny China regional strategic primacy, since that would constitute a serious blow to Australia's interests and autonomy. This is an unprecedented policy ambition, I think unique in Australia's history and not necessarily achievable. Morrison's strategy is multidimensional. It aims to deepen the alliance with the United States and military partnerships with allies in the region, boost Australia's defence budget and capability to project power into the region, and promote new ties with Indo-Pacific countries to build a deeper sense of common purpose. Now, I want to quote two competing views of Morrison's policy. One of his most intelligent critics has been our former ambassador to Beijing, Jeff Raby. Now, former Ambassador Raby has warned that Australia is making a fateful blunder. He says that China neither threatens Australia in a military sense, nor does it threaten our values. He says China is plagued by anxieties and vulnerabilities that all but rule out the projection of power by military means beyond its near abroad, and that China is unlikely to become a regional hegemon. For Raby, Australia is misinterpreting the China threat and making a related mistake. It's acting on the assumption of China as a serious strategic competitor. I think we should take that assessment and we should take that critique seriously. But I would quote another former ambassador and a current Liberal MP, Dave Sharma, who has argued that Morrison's China policy is actually world-leading, and that because Australia was subject to strong economic coercion from China, Morrison's response has been at the forefront in terms of global policy towards China. Dave Sharma said to me, quote, "I think Morrison has been at the leading edge of the global debate about China. He has been one of the first leaders to recognise and articulate the view that China's external policy is fundamentally geared to assertion and changing the global norms." So what does Morrison's policy towards China reveal about him as Prime Minister? I think Morrison has always tried to keep the door open to China while engaging in a substantial resilience strategy to ensure that Australia can withstand Beijing's pressure. He sees China's tactics as an exercise in intimidation, not just to break Australia, but there's a personal element. Morrison saw China's tactics as an effort to break him as Prime Minister, to break his resolve. And so I do believe that there was a strong personal dimension in the way that he responded to China. Morrison has been meticulous about standing by every National Security Committee of Cabinet decision about China under this phase of coalition government. I'm convinced that to show any sign of weakness would be a mistake. Morrison feels that if China succeeds in dictating to Australia, then it will simply pocket such success, move on, and repeat the tactic with other countries. He feels the challenge Australia faces today will be the challenge other nations face tomorrow. Now, critical to Morrison's resistance has been very substantial domestic political support. The Australian public has essentially supported his line against China. This has been particularly important. I might say in passing that it's rare that an Australian Prime Minister takes a significant foreign policy stance at the cost of public opinion. Sometimes it happens, but it doesn't happen too often. The Labor Party, and I think this is significant, obviously has its own nuanced approach to China, but it's important. that Labor has endorsed every major Morrison policy decision on China, while criticising Morrison's diplomacy and his motives. I think Morrison has been greatly assisted by the sheer ineptitude of China's policy, its wolf warrior diplomacy, and simply how counterproductive this has been, both in terms of Australian domestic opinion and international opinion. I quote Peter Varghese, a former head of DFAT. He said to me, quote, "I think China is probably surprised that we didn't give in, given the sheer extent of the retaliation. Australia has taken the hit. But China's tactics have turned public opinion against Beijing. This gave Scott Morrison political cover when the government otherwise would have had to carry more of the blame." The former head of DFAT, Francis Adamson, said to me, "China may reach the point where it believes it can largely set the terms of its future engagement with the world. Given this situation, Morrison has put a high premium on willpower." He sees his response in the same way, telling me, "If I was to be jittery, that would be exploited with the result that the Australian nation would begin to lose confidence." So, in summary on China, I think the key points are: China attempted to break Australia. The Australian government stood up, and in a broader sense, the Australian nation stood up. And the way we conducted ourselves, I think, became an example to the world. Did we get everything right? Of course not. But I think we should look at the fundamentals, and the fundamentals look pretty good. Let me move to the United States. More than any recent Prime Minister, Morrison faced an exacting test of US alliance management, having to deal with two contrasting presidencies, the erratic unilateralism of Donald Trump and the progressive multilateralism of Joe Biden. The democracy that put Trump and then Biden into the White House reflected a nation traumatized by domestic divisions that cast doubt on the reliability of America's role in the world. Morrison and Malcolm Turnbull before him faced a more troubled America than any Australian leader since the inauguration of the ANZUS Treaty in 1951. The paradox facing Morrison was obvious. While Beijing's assertiveness created the need for Australia to align more closely with the United States, the reliability of the United States as a senior partner was coming under its most intense questioning in decades. Now, the way Morrison operated was he attempted to establish an effective personal relationship with Trump, but he worked the administration. Joe Hockey played an invaluable role in Washington. So Morrison developed effective relations with Vice President Mike Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. They worked around Trump with senior officials in the Trump administration. I think this is an overlooked feature, but it's very, very important in the relationship. What helped Morrison enormously with Trump was Morrison's 2019 election victory, because Trump interpreted Morrison's victory as a replication of Trump's own success in America. So in a sense, he saw Morrison as a fellow traveller. Trump was excited about Morrison's victory, embraced Trump. And of course, we all know what it's like with other heads of government. Heads of government respect another head of government who's like them, just won an election. And that 2019 election victory helped Morrison with other heads of government, not just Trump. But the point I want to make is, contrary to what the Australian media repeatedly argued, the Trump-Morrison period actually saw policy differences between Australia and America that were some of the most significant in the past several decades. Disagreement over the liberal trade system, disagreement over the WTO, disagreement over Trump's protectionism, disagreement over Trump's disruptive trade war with China, disagreement over the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, disagreement over the Paris Agreement on climate, disagreement over the Iran nuclear deal, the Human Rights Council, the World Health Organization, and disagreement over the ideological framing of the contest with China. The key was the absence of a security dispute in terms of the bilateral Australian-American relationship, and that was particularly important. So I give Morrison very substantial marks, as I give Turnbull very substantial marks, for successfully conducting a relationship with Trump. It's easy in retrospect to say, well, that wasn't too hard. Well, just look at what happened with other American allies and the difficulty that the Japanese government had and many European governments had in managing relations with Trump. Now, the essential critique made of Morrison in terms of the American relationship has been that he should have qualified it more, that because the United States is plagued by domestic political traumas, it would have been intelligent for Morrison to put a bit of distance between himself and the United States. I reject this criticism. I think that this is a misreading of the situation. I think that Morrison was correct not only not to downgrade or hedge on the United States alliance, but to seek to actually deepen the alliance. And I ask the critics, what on earth was Australia supposed to get in return if we put distance between ourselves and the United States? The idea that China would have come along and offered Australia something for distancing itself from the United States is utterly fanciful. What, I ask, was Australia supposed to get in return? I quote the former head of DFAT and the former head of defence, Dennis Richardson, summing up Morrison's foreign policy towards the United States and China. And Richardson said, and I quote, "Whatever the shortcomings of America, we are always going to be closer to the United States than to China. This is not just about values, but about national interest. China has shown a propensity to interfere in our domestic affairs. Its retaliatory measures against our trade tell you how China views relations with countries like Australia if you step out of line. In global terms, would Australia be more comfortable with alliances led by the United States and like-minded countries, or a global framework dominated by China? On every count, the answer is obvious." I'll make a brief comment about AUKUS and then talk about Russia and the Ukraine. I think the interesting feature about the AUKUS nuclear-powered submarine agreement, and this is a significant global agreement involving Australia, the United States, and the United Kingdom, is this was Morrison's initiative. The idea came from Morrison. First of all, working with the Defence Department to see if it was possible to develop a nuclear-powered submarine in Australia without having a civil nuclear industry. And then when he got the green light on that, taking the idea first to Boris Johnson, getting Boris Johnson on board, and then having Morrison and Boris Johnson together take the idea to President Biden. Now, I know there are a lot of problems with this arrangement. I won't go into them now. Of course, there are problems. All I'd say is that if you think that Australia needs a long-run approach to its defence and strategic policy during the course of the 21st century, and that nuclear-powered submarines are a significant defence procurement asset for Australia, then you accept the reality that these submarines are not going to be available to 2040. Now, that is the reality here. There's no shortcut. You're not going to get these submarines after 5, 10, or 15 years. If you want them, you have to wait till 2040. And there's no point commentators complaining about this and criticising it. If you don't like it, then you should oppose the deal and say Australia should stick with conventional submarines. But if you want it and support the deal, you've got to accept that this is going to be a long-term deal. Now, Several weeks ago, President Putin invaded Ukraine. I spoke to the Prime Minister not long after this, and he argued to me that A, he wasn't surprised about this, and B, this fitted in with the global message that he'd been conveying for the past 3 years. That is, that we were seeing strategic disruption and strategic upheaval in which the autocratic nations were far more prepared to exercise military muscle. Morrison said to me that the Ukraine war would redefine the global political landscape more clearly into two camps, aggressive autocracies and most of the rest of the world. And he hoped the Russian invasion would rip away the veil that he felt had conceded the true nature of Russian and Chinese authoritarianism. Now, Morrison sees a ray of optimism in all this, because essentially what he believes is that Russia's illegal and unprovoked aggression against the Ukraine is a very big wake-up call to the liberal democracies, to the United States, to the European Union, and liberal democracies in other countries in the Indo-Pacific. Morrison believes that the two great autocracies, Russia and China, have an instinct to work together. But he does recognise that Russia and China have very different positions. He's taken a hard line against Russia, supporting sanctions, arguing that we need a very aggressive course of sanctions, leaving the impression that he would like sanctions almost of a North Korean variety, which is probably not realistic, but nonetheless an example of the hard line that Morrison has taken towards Russia in terms of this invasion. In terms of China, Morrison's been very careful. He's deliberately put a lot of pressure on China. Given the meeting between the two presidents, the president of Russia and the president of China, in early February, where they talked about a new partnership between their countries that had no limits, Morrison has put pressure on China, demanding that it formally oppose the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and put pressure on China to try and ensure that it does not try to assist Russia get round the sanctions regime. When I asked the Prime Minister what he expected from China, Morrison said to me, and I quote, "Join all the sanctions that we are imposing. It's simple. They should be responding in the same way as so many other countries. No country is going to have a bigger impact on Russia's aggression than China. But instead, they are meeting with them and they're throwing them an economic lifeline. They're creating a moral equivalence between the claims of Russia and the claims of Ukraine." So, to sum up on this issue, Morrison sees the invasion of Ukraine as being of global significance. He believes that there could be beneficial outcomes in terms of a stronger sense of resolve within the United States, within Europe, and between the Atlantic Partnership. He likes to think that this stronger sense of resolve will also carry over into the Indo-Pacific in relation to China. He's been very careful in relation to Taiwan. He's been careful to say that there is no parallel between Ukraine and Taiwan. He sees these as very different situations, and I think that's completely true and completely sound. He's been particularly keen to argue that henceforth we're going to see a situation in which economic policy and global economic policy is much more closely related to security policy and international security policy. That is, Morrison sees a new era in which economic and security issues are going to be bonded together in a far more difficult and dangerous world. Thanks very much. I'm happy to take questions.
Just to start off, just come back here, Paul. The presentation given today, very well documented, is certainly not of Scotty from marketing. What you've got here is a prime minister. We go back, Gough Whitlam, I think, you know, had a significant argument with the Nixon presidency. And now you've got the situation where Prime Minister Morrison's had a significant argument with the Chinese president. And I think other prime ministers since the war haven't really done either of those things the way that it's happened. But the resilience you refer to, as you would well know, is sort of backed up by a strong economy. In other words, could the prime minister could have done this without China's dependence on our exports, particularly on iron ore, and I think in recent time coal as well. I think they're beginning to take some coal. So to what extent does the strong economy underpin the resilience? Could he have been resilient without the strong economy?
Thanks, Gerard. I'd make 2 points in response to your question. Yes, I think Morrison's standing up to the Chinese president is a really important event looking at Australian foreign policy in post-war terms. And of course, Morrison didn't want this. It's not something Morrison chose. It's something that he felt had to be done in terms of our response to China. I think your comment about the economy is correct. We've got a highly interdependent economic and trade relationship with China. And this works both ways. What it means, of course, is that China was able to implement economic coercion against Australia in a whole range of products. And when this began, we were not certain at all about what would be the economic impact and what would be the political impact. Now, we know more about that now. What we've learnt is that we've done very well in terms of managing the economic impact. To a significant extent, we've found new markets. And what happened with the political impact was that there was a sense of resolve in Australia. So far from public opinion in Australia getting panicked and putting pressure on Morrison to back down, opinion went the other way and supported the tough line that Morrison took. But because we've got an interdependent economy with China, China is also very dependent on us, particularly in the resources, energy and iron ore sector. And so that means, of course, that China has also got to be very careful about the way it behaves in terms of those particular and sensitive commodities. I guess one of the really fascinating things is what happens over time in terms of the economic relationship. Might it deteriorate further, or might over time we see a degree of restoration?
Just stay there, Paul. Just stay. There's a question over here. You just stay here.
Yes. A curious item I read in Bloomberg the other day, we related to aluminium. And what it purported to say was Australia has introduced an embargo on the export of aluminium to Russia, which is of particular importance given its Russian dependence on aluminium imports for military purposes, etc. And I wondered what your comment would be on that, given that we've been very careful in relation to China to make sure that the trade interference was always from that end and not ours. We have proven to be a reliable, consistent market supplier to China, I suspect as a matter of total policy. Do you think that making this laudable, perhaps, exception in relation to Russia and aluminium sets a bad precedent in terms of how it might be viewed in China?
I think what it means is that the world has changed. And it's changed in a short time in a really profound way. So essentially what's happened is Western nations, led by Biden and the Europeans and Germany, have decided that they're not going to involve themselves in a military conflict in Ukraine. Biden has said that every inch of NATO territory will be defended in a military sense. But Ukraine is not a member of NATO. So the West is not making a military commitment as such to NATO. The West feels guilty about this, feels particularly guilty about this. And so what's happened is we've seen an extraordinary new form of economic warfare. unleashed against President Putin, drawing upon all the arms of the globalized world. So, in particular, trade and finance. So we see an array of sanctions being taken against Russia in trade terms, in energy terms, but in particular in finance terms. And we've seen this unprecedented action being taken against the Russian Central Bank to isolate the Russian Central Bank, to ensure that it can't access its reserves, which means it's not going to be able to defend its own currency, which will have enormous repercussions for the Russian economy. So my point in relation to your question is that Australia is supporting these sanctions against Russia, and we're supporting them in a very active way. And this is a fundamental change in global rules and in global outlook in terms of attempting to combat Russia and come to grips with the military campaign that Russia is waging in the Ukraine. So I think this is the right thing to do. It represents, as I said, a fundamental change in the global economic outlook and global strategy. China, at some stage in the future, may attempt to use this one way or another, but that's not going to be relevant at the moment, because China is under critical pressure now, critical foreign policy pressure. Biden has publicly said there will be serious consequences for China if China engages in support for Russia to get round the sanctions, to try to avoid the sanctions, given that Russia is now engaged in an unprovoked territorial campaign and invasion of Ukraine. If China is seen to be a supporter of that Russian campaign in terms of economic support to Russia, that is going to destroy the essential framework of Chinese foreign policy as it's been propagated over the last 30 years.
So there's a question here, Paul.
Paul, you correctly said there is no nexus between Taiwan and Ukraine. I'd like your comment, because I think there's an historical overarching nexus in China's attitude to Taiwan, China's concept of the self in the world, and Putin's concept of Russia in the world. First of all,
I've got to be brief because
the
microphone isn't working.
Neither Putin nor Xi are the first leaders of their two countries to have concept of overarching historical importance of their countries, and I think this is a very dangerous thing
for
the West
must
face.
Okay. Paul?
Okay. I concede there's some degree of similarity in the way Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin look at Taiwan and Ukraine. There are also a lot of differences. However, in geostrategic terms, there is a fundamental difference. Russia has invaded Ukraine, and there is no direct great power military response. There is no military response from the United States. There is no military response from NATO. Now, while the policy in relation to Taiwan is strategic ambiguity, there is nonetheless an assumption that if China took military action in relation to Taiwan, there would be a United States military response. Now, that is a broad assumption. And because that's such a broad assumption, that's something that Beijing must consider all the time in relation to its military options over Taiwan. Putin didn't have that worry in relation to his military options over Ukraine. That is a fundamental strategic difference.
So there's a question here. Yes.
Thank you. Given the possibility that the Labor Party may win the next election, unwelcome though it may be to many of us here, how do you see the current leadership there having the grunt or resolve, as you say, to continue the kind of policy that Morrison has taken up with China and our other international partners?
Okay, I'd make a few points about that. The first point to make is that Anthony Albanese is a veteran of Australian politics, but really, like what Scott Morrison was, he's not versed deeply in foreign policy and national security. And I think he's very reliant on Penny Wong, the shadow foreign minister, when it comes to national security and foreign policy. And I think in the past, there's been a degree of apprehension in terms of the way Anthony Albanese does talk about foreign policy and strategic policy, precisely because he's not deeply versed in it. Now, he took a tactical decision after he became leader of the Labor Party that he would ensure that there was no significant policy difference between himself and the Morrison government on defence, foreign and national security policy. Now, he took that decision as a domestic political tactic, and he's adhered to that. And that's been particularly important because he supported the government on a whole series of China policies, which, if you look back at Labor's history, you might argue, well, it wasn't naturally foreordained at all that Labor would support all these tough positions on China, but it has, and that's significant. However, what I would say is this. I think the Labor agenda, as it's been devised, is an agenda designed to win an election. It's not necessarily a Labor agenda of conviction. So the question I would ask is, where is Labor's conviction in 2022? They haven't been in government at the national level since 2013. The world has changed. It's a different world. So it's one thing to get elected on a particular agenda, but if you're governing and you're running a foreign policy and a national security policy, those policies reflect your beliefs and your convictions. So the question I ask is, if Labor wins the election, will we see a process playing out in which a party that's been elected on an agenda to win an election has got to then decide in government what its agenda of conviction really is? I think that could be an interesting situation under a Labor government.
We've got a question over here.
Thank you. To a large extent, Russia and China's strategies have been funded by the West by buying Russia's wheat, oil, gas, and in the case of China, transferring our factories to their country. And you said that it was important that Australia was successful in standing up to China. That's going to require Western countries to realign the way they do their economies and to purchase more from each other and possibly less from Russia and China. Do you see that as a possibility?
Well, the first point to make here is that while Australia and China at the moment are strategic rivals to a significant extent, they also have a strategic common interest in their economic relationship, their trade relationship, and the magnitude of it. So I think that this is going to be an evolving story. There is no way Australia can replace China in the near term in terms of China's economic and trade importance for this country. That's not going to happen. We can't find any other country to replace China. That won't happen. Over a period of years, we can sensibly attempt to look for new markets and diversify. And of course, we'll see changes in the Chinese economy. We can expect that China's growth rate will come off. We'll see structural changes in the nature of China's economy. And this means that the economic partnership between Australia and China will also change. But both countries do see a very strong common economic interest. So neither country has got an interest in going out immediately and destroying that. So I think we'll see tensions here as the strategic differences play out across the backdrop, of course, of the common economic interest, and Australia being very much aware that we can't find any automatic replacement for China. It doesn't exist. Sure, we'll work with India, but India is always going to be a slow story. So both countries are going to have to evolve and judge the national interest as they go on in both strategic and trade terms.
Final question over here.
Thanks, Paul. To your point about conviction, what would you say to the proposition that Morrison has run a conviction foreign policy but hasn't been a conviction politician domestically?
I think the argument that he hasn't been a sufficient conviction politician domestically has got some credence. I guess where it has got credence is, if you like, in terms of the cultural agenda playing to the Liberal base. When I talk about this, the two policy areas that I identify are school performance and school curriculum, where the national government has a very important say. And Alan Tudge, as the former education minister, had very strong convictions there. And the other area, of course, is the whole domain of identity politics. And it does seem to me that the Prime Minister could have been far more involved in both these areas. And if he had done so, I think the positions he might have taken, the positions he would have taken, would have actually been popular with the electorate. So this, I think, would have been a situation in which Morrison could have taken a conservative position that actually won kudos from the electorate. But I am a little bit careful in saying that, in going along with the critique that he hasn't been a sufficiently a conviction politician in domestic terms, because the story in domestic terms this term has been fighting the global pandemic. It's been fighting COVID-19. And the government's record here has been a stellar world-leading performance. So essentially what we've seen here is that Australia's vaccination rate, very high in global terms. Australia's death rate, very low in global terms. Australia's economic recovery, virtually unmatched in global terms. I believe in years to come, we will look back at Australia's performance in terms of fighting COVID-19 to say that this was one of our finest policy moments since World War II. And this raises another interesting question. If this is the major policy challenge that the Morrison government faced this term, and if it's had very significant success, as I believe it has, in terms of the fundamental outcome, why is the Morrison government facing what seems to be a complete election wipeout as far as the polls are concerned? So what we see here is a conflict between objective performance and results on the one hand and the subjective mood of the people on the other hand, which is to boot out the government.
Paul, many thanks. Look, we had more questions, but we're right on time and we always finish on time. So congratulations for a fine performance tonight. I should also thank King and Wood Mellisons for giving us this great facility. And as I said, copies of Morrison's mission is available. So we thank you for your performance tonight and we wish you all the best with your book, and we'll see you back in the future. Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.